lightning collecting terminals on the radio tower. In other words, they'll have these sharp, spiky things as high as they can get on the tower, and hopefully the lightning is attracted to it rather than the antennas. There are stories of something really rugged, like a station master antenna taking a direct strike where the fiberglass outer radome on the antenna becomes thoroughly blasted away. So a direct lightning strike can really be terrible. Joe, WHYY, go right ahead. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I've often wondered about this. Like during a thunderstorm, if lightning happens to hit a very high voltage line, say like, I'll give you an example, a 69 kV line, and it happens to hit it at the point where it's at the peak of a particular cycle on a particular phase, and that phase is being transferred down to you, down the street, somehow, somewhere, through everything. Can all these other transformers handle that kind of instantaneous surge and actually transfer most of that energy to you? Does it have any limitation that would cause them to arc over internally? In other words, if the 69,000 volts, for example, all of a sudden became like, say, 900,000 or 1,200,000 volts to ground for a split second, would that result in transfer down the line actually be in a linear type of progression, or do you think these transformers would tend to shunt some of that energy also? Back to you.
When you do an optimum design of a transformer, like say for instance you've got a 69 kilovolt distribution line, transmission line, 69 volt transmission line, which is then going to be cut down to, we'll say 240 volts for distribution, or some lower number. When you do an optimum design of that transformer, you want to make sure that the magnetic circuit does not hit saturation. You choose the right turns ratio on primary and secondary so you're not saturating the core. However, you don't carry that too far. If you use a really large number of turns, now you're ending up with a lot of resistance in the wiring, and you're using up the EI lamination, the hole where you can put the wiring gets used up too fast. So there's an optimum design of the transformer where, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, maybe you come up to 50% of the magnetic saturation level in normal operation. Therefore, when a lightning strike hits your 69 kilovolt line in your example, not much of that energy is coupled through without the magnetic field hitting saturation.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized, because it was only at 50% of saturation to be coupled to begin with. So when it comes to transformer operation, could it double the voltage? Yes. Could it multiply the voltage by 100? I don't think the magnetic core would tolerate that. That's the good news. The bad news is that lightning strike hitting the wiring of that transformer can lift the whole transformer and all of its wiring above ground by some large number of volts, depending on the inductance of that wiring to its grounding system. That's a theory on my part. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on this one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Your part two, Dick, was 100%. That's exactly the mode of failure when lightning hits basically the power lines, especially the high-tension power lines. That the biggest problem with power line interference from lightning is basically the surge in the ground, or it doesn't even have to open the ground. It basically causes a surge of current that is excessive. In other words, when most people look at ground wires, you know, 6-gauge wire going into ground, and there's an impedance on it that's generally better than 25 ohms, maybe 25 down to maybe 1 ohm. But it's hard to expect that you're going to have a ground impedance of 1 ohm. But you put 1,000 amps of current surge into 1 to 20 ohms, you can imagine the kind of voltage drop that you're generating across the ground system. So you wind up with this ground system elevated at a much higher voltage with respect to everything around it. That's really the damaging factor. Now, let me let this drop for a second. The issue of having a lightning strike elevate the line-to-line voltage of the transformer is not, it really is, it's, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's not so likely. And here's the real reason why. The lightning basically is basically energy in the sky trying to find its way through the wire to ground or back down to earth. So the path at which it's taking is basically either through the wire down to somehow trying to find ground. So it's not really generating that lightning voltage very easily from line to neutral. Because if you look at all the lines, the way that they're on a telephone pole, they're line, line, and line, and neutral is basically tied to a ground on the other side. So your chances of actually getting the line voltage spike of the lightning directly on from line to neutral is not all that likely. In most cases, it's really elevating the ground. That's the bigger problem. And there are also things on the line within the transformer that are designed to blow out. There are circuit breakers inside the transformer, so that if they are forced by something like lightning to drive them into an overvoltage condition, they will saturate and then blow the fuse. And that does happen occasionally. LIPO will have to come around and replace those fuses on the pig pole transformers. I'm going to pass back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
A very quick question to put in there, Dick.
Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I'll try not to do this too many times. But I have heard many times that lightning does not strike from the sky down, but from the ground up. And I kind of think that's true, but how do you feel about that?
I'm fairly sure there's multiple answers on this one. I bought a number of books on the subject of lightning over the last couple of years, and the majority of our lightning strikes, the cloud itself is negatively charged with reference to Earth, and that's your typical lightning bolt. But a small percentage of the time, for whatever reason, Mother Nature does it backwards, where the lightning, the cloud is positive with reference to ground, and those particular lightning bolts are 10 times louder, 10 times higher in current. And so when you take a photograph, as a good friend of mine does, let's see now, can't think of his call letters all of a sudden. There's a guy who does quite a bit of photography of lightning. The majority of the lightning bolts that you'll see he has taken pictures of look like an upside-down tree. In other words, the trunk is up high and all the branches are down low and some of those branches touch the ground. However, occasionally he gets the opposite photograph. I think it's an opposite polarity lightning storm, where it now looks like a right-side-up tree. Also, when it comes to the actual process of the lightning, where you have these leaders that ionize a path between the cloud and ground, and when they finally ionize that path, then the current surge through that path looks like it starts at ground level and propagates upward. So is lightning top-down or bottom-up? It's all of the above, depending on which portion of the procedure, which polarity that particular lightning storm was, and so on. It's all we can say for sure, Barry, is that there's a lot of energy there, and when that 11,000 ampere typical lightning strike hits your and my grounding system, let me drop. And if we did a real good job of putting in grounding rods of just the right diameter and length and just the right kind of conductivity in soil, and you think you've exceeded something like 1 ohm, and very few of us get anywhere near down that low, 1 ohm of our grounding rod to the rest of Mother Earth, and you and I think we've got a damn good ground. 11,000 amperes across 1 ohm is 11,000 volts. That circuit and all of that dirt around that grounding rod that you think is grounded is now 11,000 volts above ground during that lightning bolt. And so terrible things are going to happen. You can see how, no matter how hard you try, you're never going to get perfect protection. Every one of the lightning protection techniques we use give a certain percentage of protection. But I can tell you I really look real hard at the weather before I climb my tower. I don't want to be on my tower when a lightning storm is nearby. So maybe that gives you some of the information you're looking for. I guess it was John that was asking this question. Hey, with any further comments on lightning, and that's a tough one, give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2CMP.
That's the issue.
Go ahead, Bill, and then Western Night Auto. Bill first.
Personal experience, just going back to actually the childhood, I grew up with a 40-foot directional beam in my backyard. My father was very big at this back in the days. We actually had a lightning hit that beam, and it was the beam itself was 40 feet, you know, plus the radius probably 50 foot plus. And direct hit, which blasted it out the back window. And what did it do? It took down a house three doors down, maybe, because their TV antenna was very popular at the time, wasn't properly grounded. And the fire trucks were over there, and the whole house shook. No equipment was damaged, but I always, I guess, attributed that to the fact that there were 1-inch, 10-foot threaded rods going into the ground, and that was the base because the beam was supported by But to secure that properly, my father had to put the threaded rod into the ground, you know, with the cement and everything else like that, you know, 1-inch steel rods, and properly grounded. And I watched the lightning bounce off the beam and take out a house a couple doors down. Very impressive, but good grounding is very important now. You know, with my simple antenna system, obviously I have good grounding and everything. I just always wondered, again, what a piece of fairly, best way I could phrase it is, not sturdy piece of conduit is actually what I could bring into the house, and that was my concern, and that was my original question. But, you know, life is a funny thing, but, the ground didn't light up, and, we survived, but the ungrounded TV antenna down the block with the whole house up.
Bill, you could use some more audio. You got to talk a little louder. What convinced you that the particular strike that hit your antenna was the exact same one that also hit the house down the block? I mean, you made it sound like it bounced off your antenna and then went to that house. It is also possible that particular lightning strike, if you were standing a mile away taking a good photograph, that the trunk of the tree up high of the lightning bolt split into two branches. One branch went to your antenna, one branch went to the neighbor down the block, and they happened sort of simultaneously. I can sort of accept that. But to bounce off your antenna and go to the neighbor, that's a little bit tough to accept.
KC2, QIQ with a comment on that one?
Okay, I'm going to go to Glenn in a minute, but the cable that you and I bring into the house, we've got a conflict of interest here. When we try to use coaxial cable that's very low in loss, it tends to be larger in diameter, lower in ohmic resistance, therefore the particular peak surge current it's capable of bringing into the house is larger before it vaporizes. But rarely does an amateur select the diameter of his coaxial cable in order to limit lightning. A much better approach, by the way, would be to have a few turns of the coax cable. As the cable exits the house, if you build yourself a poor man's ballon, a number of turns of the coaxial cable taped together right at that point before it proceeds up the tower, so to speak, that would be a local RF choke. As such, it would definitely limit the amount of surge current that will come down that cable and then enter your house. So that's one partial protection, in my opinion. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
I'm sorry I didn't catch the other gentleman's call, but what he's described is something that I've seen happen in Florida many, many times. I've seen it in videos many, many times. I've seen a video that was fantastic. If I can find it, Dick, I'll try to send it to you via an email if I can locate it again. But basically it shows this was a lightning event that was taking place in Chicago. And you can see the lightning wrapping around the building. It's going down the side, travels down to the street level, strikes a manhole cover, and I guess the manhole cover gets actually lifted and blown off of the top of the manhole and gets knocked to the sidewalk. And I've seen this kind of arrangement happen quite a few times. And the way that this has been described to me by people who are in better knowledge than I am on this particular topic is that the clouds have similar charge, and basically when you have a cloud charge, it's not always the cloud going to Mother Earth or Earth ground. It's many, many times it's from a difference in low pressure from one cloud to the next, or two clouds crossing over each other. And sometimes if that energy comes to very, very low levels near ground level, let me let this drop, you can get a windy situation happening down a city street where you have one cloud cover coming down at very, very low level, and then another wind shear coming at another level, and the interreaction between those two shears are distributing a lot of charge between those two air masses, and the lightning literally bounces off of things left and right, and as long as the tower is grounded, it doesn't get elevated in voltage to arc over. Where you have something that's not grounded properly to Earth, basically what will happen is, like that manhole cover, you think it's well grounded because it's sitting on a metal cover on the top, but apparently there was enough resistance, maybe the oxidation of the cover, where the energy got caught on the cover and actually lifted it and threw it off of the manhole cover. So these kinds of things do happen. It's crazy to even try to analyze it, but they do happen, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Lots of energy that can do all kinds of funny things. Cloud-to-cloud lightning is quite a bit more prevalent than cloud-to-ground. But cloud-to-ground is more than enough of it to keep us on our toes, if you know what I mean, Bill. It's a tough one, and it's a subject that we're going to be discussing quite a number of times in the future. I guarantee we haven't heard all the words on this one. And with any further comments, give me your call letters, K2RIW.
Yeah, I have a question for both Dick and Glenn. The reverse polarity of the lightning. A little bit more information about it. Should I understand then that ground is positive versus the cloud? And in terms of molecular structure, how or any other mechanism that is ruling that, or you think it's ruling that, any comment on it? And thank you.
Of the books I've read so far, Wes, what is the mechanism by which a thunderstorm creates this huge cloud charge, many coulombs of electrical energy, ends up on the cloud, usually negative, occasionally positive? The mechanism by which that occurs is not understood. How does Mother Nature do that? There's lots and lots of theories. Nobody's got a good answer on that. So we can't answer in the first place, in a well-respected manner, how the cloud becomes charged. And then the next step of that is, how does it sometimes become charged positive on the top of the cloud, negative on the bottom of the cloud? And sometimes the cloud builds up a charge upside down. How does it do that? I don't think it's understood. They believe the convective current, in other words, your low-pressure area is an area where moist air is being drawn in from the perimeter of the storm, drawn in toward the center. It rises in the center to higher altitudes, where the warm air experiences a lower pressure and a lower temperature and starts converting back from water vapor into rain. And the rain is the main mechanism that powers the thunderstorm, powers the cyclone, powers the tornado, powers all of these things. You get a tremendous amount of energy back when you convert moist air into water, rain. That's 540 calories per gram, tremendous amount of energy. So you get this hot chimney of air in the center drawing in moisture from the perimeter, and as that moist, warm air is drawn to a higher altitude by some mysterious method of those individual water vapor molecules rubbing against each other or whatever. They're not quite sure what it is, how that charge is built up. Mother Nature certainly does it, but I don't think anybody's got a clear explanation.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I don't think anybody's got a clear explanation as to how that takes place. Let me stand by and see if anybody knows how is the charge built up in the cloud in the first place, regardless of its polarity. Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm telling you, based on the duration that you were already touched in here on the TechNet, it's a friction between the layers of the atmosphere. But I have interesting fact. I just want to hear first confirmation that it is possible that Earth would be positively charged versus the clouds and whatsoever. Because what I found in here is from paleomagnetism.
Go ahead.
Lightning strike king a rock can instantly reverse its polarity. I'm puzzled by the fact that if a positive charge exists in the Earth, then we have to have this part of the Earth with the neutral zones to the rest of the Earth. We have to have a boundary, we have to have a sort of capacitive phenomena whatsoever. I just want to hear from both of you, Glenn and Dick. Is it possible that by reverse polarity you understand that this part of the Earth is positively charged or reversely charged? And to
I might have something to add to that, Dick.
Yeah, before we go to Glenn, somebody said related comment. Who was that? Give me your call letters and your related comment and name. K2RIW.
This is KC2IS, Bill, and just recalling an experiment where you could have a stream of water charged, I believe, and have that running through another charge loop, I believe an opposite charge on the loop, and if the stream of water got thin enough, it would turn to droplets, and then the droplets, if they passed close enough to the edge of the loop, would themselves arc. They would loop the loop through that loop, and I'm wondering if maybe somehow that would relate to this phenomenon, the charge staying in the cloud once it got there.
Yeah, I forgot the name of this device, and Bill, you could use some more audio. There's a kind of device where you have dripping water through a mechanism of these two rings that are interconnected in a particular way, and when you do it just right, it builds up a static charge not too different from the operation of a Wimshurst machine that John and I, KC2WGB, we both own a Wimshurst machine. When you go to John's QIZ.com, of the many pictures of the equipment in his laboratory, one of the things you'll see is a Wimshurst machine, which can develop something like 100,000 volts by just turning its handle, these two plastic discs with metal contacts on them, turn clockwise and counterclockwise close to each other and build up a very high charge. The mechanism by which that works, that's called electrostatic induction. It's an induction machine. And this water dropping machine is also an induction machine, which can build up a charge. And is the upside down rain process doing that to build up the charge in the cloud? Is an interesting hypothesis, Bill. You don't have that whole mechanism there to support the charge buildup, but maybe Mother Nature supplies it by some kind of a mysterious means. And is the ground near a cloud positive or negative? The answer is yes. In other words, the way opposite charge attract each other, let me drop it.
Yeah, it's also to be noted, all the planets that have an atmosphere, any kind of atmosphere, appear to have lightning.
That's a good point, Barry. When you take a look at some of the better photographs that we've gotten recently of Saturn, Jupiter, and I think even Venus, any of the atmospheres that are around any of those planets under certain conditions will produce some lightning. So just the convective action of hot and cold areas and air movement in an atmosphere with and without moisture of various kinds can build up a static charge and lightning occurs. The exact mechanism is not very well known, but if a highly negatively charged cloud drifts over my town, because negative and positives will attract each other, the local ground underneath that cloud does acquire a more positive charge compared to the rest of the earth around it. And as such, you can see how there's a kind of a runaway condition which makes an arc eventually take place. But still, the arcing process is complicated. It happens in stages. With rare exception, a lightning bolt doesn't simply jump from the cloud to ground, because the amount of voltage on the cloud, as big as it is still 10 to 1 or 100 to 1 too small to arc that many miles or thousands of feet of air. So if it moves in stages. So if you take high-speed photography of a lightning event, you see a whole bunch of these leaders that move in roughly 120-foot jumps at a time, and there are many people who think that local cosmic rays are the initiating event that make the individual leaders, and that's why you've got this upside-down tree most of the time. You've got a whole bunch of branches going out, and the tips of each one of those branches, the charge gets that point, and if a cosmic ray doesn't come by at the right period of time to continue the event, the whole thing stops. That's why a number of the branches of that upside-down tree don't go anywhere. They don't manage to make it to ground.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But some of those branches don't make it to ground while others do, and that's because of local cosmic rays did or did not support the propagation of the rest of the process. That's one of the theories. It's a tough one, and it's something to treat with a lot of respect. If a thunderstorm is coming into your neighborhood and you know about it, If you're a real conservative person, you start disconnecting things, and you certainly don't climb to the top of your tower at that period of time. At least I don't. Okay, we're going to go on now to...
Glenn wanted to take a stand.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I think Dick explained mostly what I was, you know, what I was talking about, you know, about differential charges. Wesley, I was just going to add that, you know, we're referencing everything to Earth. That's because that's what we're standing on. So when we're looking at our grounds, we're thinking of those grounds being more positive than the charge in the air, as Dick had explained. But maybe the only other thing I can add to that is that keep in mind that the airflow is it's fluid. It's a that cloud is moving. It's in motion. And when you're if you're like standing, you know, maybe on a beachfront or something, and you're standing on ground and you see that very very dark cloud coming in on that storm front where all that energy is located, right on the leading edge of that storm front, you can pretty much be assured that that's a very very large negatively charged item with respect to the ground that you're standing on. But keep in mind, as that storm keeps on getting closer, or as that storm front passes over on top of you, what's happening is there's so much violence in the wind of that charge moving around that you can wind up with similar charge within that airflow, so that actually you could wind up with a more negative on one side, and the other side of it, behind it with all that fluid of air motion, will actually even be more positive than the ground that you're standing on because of all the dissimilar charge. But that's about all that I have to add, Dick. I'm going to pass it back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Guys, I'm kind of confused. Do we have a negative and more negative and positive and more positive? I want to hear the straight answer. Could the ground be at positive charge versus the cloud, or reverse charge versus the cloud? Yes or no?
Yes.
Good. Then this part of the ground is supposed to be have a neutral area to the rest of the ground. It must be a capacitive component that or the capacitive reaction between this particular part of the ground towards the rest of the surrounding ground. It must be some kind of the energy accumulation and by the same token the energy dissipation, not only towards the cloud, but towards the capacitor that is in between the border. N2MBR.
N2MBR recognized. Get to you in a second, sir. There's something else going on here that we haven't recognized, Wesley. And you can see the effect with an electroscope. An electroscope is one of these things that looks like a flask with a rubber cork usually coming out of the top, a rod coming through the middle of the cork, and down at the bottom of the rod, inside the flask, you've got these two gold leaves. And as you bring charge near the electroscope, the two gold leaves will separate, and the amount of separation tells you the amount of charge. What's really crazy about electrostatics is that I don't have to bring anything in contact with the electroscope to get the effect. I can charge up a glass rod by rubbing wool over it, so to speak. I can bring the glass rod near the electroscope. Don't even touch it. If my rod was, let me pick a number, positive, and I bring it near the electroscope, what happens is that the charge, the electroscope itself starts out as completely neutral. However, the charges within the rod of the electroscope will themselves separate. If my rod that I'm bringing nearby is positive, the positive charges will move down to the bottom of the electroscope and separate the two gold leaves. The negative charges will move toward the top of the bulb on the rod coming out of the electroscope. I am separating the charges within the rod of the electroscope, but even though the total electroscope is still as a composite device, it is neutral, but the charges separate within it just because I brought a charged device nearby. I think a cloud passing over your town has a somewhat similar effect. Let's see if Glenn agrees with that one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I do agree, Dick, but I don't know if my Steve's making it in. KC2QIQ.
You're very noisy, but you said you did agree, and you got it. N2 and November Bravo Radio, a thought of your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Now, here is John in New York. The illustration for some of this, anyway, is toll booth and you drive your car up to the toll booth and you've just been doing 60 or 70 miles an hour on the thruway, you'll notice that I think most of the time, if not all the time, a little wire sticking up off the ground, sticking out of the ground, so that your front bumper will hit that wire before you electrocute the toll taker or give him a really bad shock. And let me let this drop. And the other is a form of a question. If you have a surge protector, garden variety, you know, Home Depot type surge protector, a Falcon or one of those, and it happens to be plugged in, let's say you have opposing bathrooms in your house, you know, one in the master bedroom and the other one in the guest bathroom like I have, you have surge protector on one side but not the other. Does the surge protector that you have protect the outlets on the other side of the wall, so to speak, vis-a-vis the thermistor or whatever they use? I'm not totally unfamiliar with the schematic here, but in other words, you still have to buy a second surge protector. Go ahead, Jeff.
Don't they put carbon or something in car tires now to make that effect where they have to discharge it, so you don't have to do that anymore?
Don't forget the car tires on the ground.
Yeah, you're correct, Barry. The tires are more conductive these days, so the amount of static discharge, the amount of static buildup in an automobile is decreased. But to be double down sure, you've got that piece of wire sticking out of the ground near the toll booth so that you're not continuously shocking the poor toll taker. It's a belt and suspenders just to make sure, because somebody might be using a vehicle that has improper tires, or even if the tires are conductive, there is the possibility with fresh grease in the bearings of your automobile that wheel is isolated from the rest of the vehicle. I think they put conductive material in the wheel bearing grease these days to try to get around that. In the old days, there used to be a little bit of a sharp point in the center of the grease cap on the bearing cover on each one of your wheels in order to ground that system so you didn't get static buildup that gave you improper radio reception. But what you're discussing, John, into NBR is a so-called ground fault detector, ground fault indicator. There's a kind of a protection device built into a socket that you should have in the bathroom and in the kitchen for sure, which what that circuit does, let me drop, is it looks at the ratio of the current flowing out the hot lead and the current flowing back into the common lead of the, in other words, you've got a hot lead and a cold lead, so to speak, as well as the third lead, which is the safety grounding lead. If the current imbalance between the hot lead and the cold lead is, let me pick a number, 10 milliamps or less or more, it trips a relay inside that disconnects that circuit. And what really happens is that if, for instance, there was improper wiring in your drill motor that you're using, and you happen to be using your drill motor in the kitchen, and I've done that, and so that the hot lead is touching the metal case of this old-fashioned drill motor, my hand is on that drill motor, and my other hand is touching the water pipe, the water faucet, and I now is 110 volts across my body. Current will flow out of the hot lead of the socket in the wall that will be less than the amount of current flowing back into the ground lead, so to speak, the return lead. There'll be a current imbalance because of the current flowing from me. That circuit is supposed to protect that, disconnect that circuit, and save my life. So in theory, you need those ground fault protector circuits in each individual location, kitchen and bathroom for sure, and maybe other places in the house, maybe the wall socket you've got outside the house. For human safety reasons, you should have them there. Should you cascade them so that the one is in this room and that wiring goes over to the bathroom, I wouldn't trust it. I think the only way you can really be safe is to put them into each individual room that needs them. That's my belief on that. Glenn, you probably have more knowledge on this one if you're within the radio range. KC2QIQ, if possible. K2LIW in the TechNet. Thank you. range right now, John. But to be double-down sure, you should have that exact circuit in each of the locations that are needed, and don't depend on the cascading of those to give you protection. Because of the various ways your house can be wired, you might not be protected if you've got them cascaded. That's my belief on that one, so don't skimp on that one. I think that would be penny-wise, pound-foolish. What kind of questions have we gotten for the mailbag this week, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the Tech Net.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net. Okay. We got a 13-year-old who has a question for you. He now has a 2-meter, 20-watt transceiver, and he's got a 100-watt amplifier for it. But he is worried about his coax cable and antenna melting. Can he go ahead and use the linear without worrying about that? Or do you have any suggestions for him? And this is Jim in New Jersey, KC2WGB.
I personally have done that lots and lots of times, John. The Mirage amplifier, Mirage Baker 1016, I think it is. I'm trying to remember the model number. I've got one sitting here. I can't read the model number on it. But anyhow, there is a Mirage amplifier that's rated for 160 watts output, and mine on a good day will give me 180 watts. I've got that in my automobile, and the output of that 180 watt amplifier goes to a piece of RG58 coaxial cable that goes to the antenna on the roof of my automobile. And I ran that thing for a decade that way, never since that the cable got hot or had any grief. So 100 watts or 180 watts into a piece of RG58 at 2 meters, 144 megacycles, can definitely take it. You're starting to push your luck a little bit if you ran 180 watts into a piece of RG58 at 450 megacycles, because the cable, by definition, has more loss, roughly twice the loss when you go to that higher frequency, and as such, the cable's going to run a little bit hotter. When it comes to a piece of RG8 coaxial cable, let me drop. The old-fashioned type RG8 coaxial cable, RG213 is called these days, but RG8 with polyethylene coaxial insulation. I ran a piece of that cable out of my K2RAW parallel kilowatt amplifier at 432. In other words, at 700 watts of key down continuous power coming out of an amplifier, I could put it through an ordinary piece of polyethylene RG8 cable. The cable got hot to the touch. It got, let's say, more than warm, but not hot. And the cable became extra flexible when I would run that key down 10 minutes with 700 watts through it. That's about the limit, in my opinion. So RG8 at 450 can take 700 watts continuously when in open air. If it was inside of a conduit where there wasn't free airflow, I think you'd get yourself in trouble. RG58 out in the open air of my automobile, coming out of the amplifier, sitting on the floor, and actually the amplifier sometimes sits under the seat, and then comes out of that cable, which goes around the rubber door seal of the car and onto the antenna on the roof. 180 watts into a place of RG58 can take it. Now, there are super small diameter coaxial cables where you'd be pushing your luck. What's the maximum power rating for each of these cables? You can look that up. Each brand name will tell you at each frequency range what the insertion loss is in dB per 100 feet and what the maximum power is. But those are my pieces of experience. I bet you had somewhat similar experience with your cables and your amplifiers, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, you're 100% right. I've run some heavy power on RG58. The cable got warm, and that was also at the UHF frequencies. The antenna, no problem. I never worried about melting an antenna. In free air, they could probably take a kilowatt without any problem. So I don't think Jim has any issue there. I would recommend for him to go ahead and hook that up. But yes, I've experienced almost exactly what you said. And I've noticed that, and that's very important to realize, it has to be in free air. Even 60-cycle cable, those ratings are free air with plenty of circulation. You have to derate as soon as you can find them because of the airflow. Okay, on to the next one here. Let me get there. Okay, Dick, we have a gentleman here that wants your impressions on how you think radio communication on Mars could be different than here on Earth. Now, this is going to be from, say, walkie-talkie to walkie-talkie or base station to base station, not to orbiters. So now, with the difference in no magnetic field, atmospheric conditions, the terrain, all of the issues of Mars that are quite different than here on Earth, what do you think is going to be the difference that they're going to run into when they have to communicate, if there's going to be any? What's your impression? Back to you, Dick, KC2WGV.
Try to give that answer, Dick, to frequency, because, boy, is that going to be a big, big variance.
Yes, exactly.
A big function of frequency, a big function of terrain. I'm going to give you two examples. When Owen Garriott, W5LFL, was on space shuttle number 6, I think it was, way back in 1985, and he's flying over northern Texas heading toward New York City in that particular orbit of the space shuttle, and with a antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle, and the space shuttle was upside down, so the window was facing the Earth, and in his hand was a 5-watt Motorola handy-talkie, and he starts saying CQ 2 meters or whatever he said, and here I am 1,500 miles away with the 5/8 wave mag mount antenna on the roof of my automobile in the parking lot of Airborne Instruments Laboratory in Deer Park, New York. I'm 1,500 miles away from a 5-watt transmitter that's 200 miles above the Earth over Texas. He had essentially direct line of sight to me 1,500 miles away. Handy-talkie to handy-talkie, he was giving me 15 dB. I was nearly dead full quieting, listening to his signal 1,500 miles away in free space. You take that exact pair of handy-talkies, that Motorola handy-talkie from Owen Garriott and my handy-talkie, and you put them in front of my house, and you have me, I walk north on my street, somebody else walks south on my street, and we try to talk to each other. By the time we get approximately 1 or 2 miles apart, we're going to start having trouble. What happened? How come 1 or 2 miles on the surface of the Earth is the distance that you can reliably talk handy-talkie to handy-talkie, but yet in free space, 1,500 miles was easy? Let me drop. Down on Earth, you've got trees, buildings, water towers, all kinds of obstructions. You've got Earth curvature. The trees are quite absorptive. You've got the in well-built-up areas, there's all kinds of shrubs and trees and whatever, and a 2-meter signal sifting through those trees is going to experience a significant number of decibels per mile. I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me it's 50 decibels or 100 decibels per mile, I'd agree with it. So the terrain counts a lot. 2 meters, you almost never get ionospheric reflection, with rare exception. We get a sporadic e-cloud once in a while, but it's kind of rare. Mars has a small fraction of 1% of the amount of atmosphere on Earth, so there probably is very little ionosphere on Mars because there's so little atmosphere. Let me drop. And part of what's happening when you and I with a handy-talkie, even if I choose the Mojave Desert where there's no local foliage, and I do that same experiment with handy-talkie to handy-talkie on a flat terrain area, I go up to the Antelope Valley near Palmdale, California, and you and I are on Highway 14, the Antelope Valley Highway, and we start walking away from each other in that desert environment where there's no local foliage, they got nothing but clear, wide, open space and road. Instead of starting having communication problems with handy-talkie to handy-talkie at 1 or 2 miles, maybe we're going to get 10 miles. What starts happening to you at 10 miles is Earth curvature starts happening. At 10 miles, you draw a line of sight between me standing on the ground and you standing on the ground. The Earth in between us is bulging up about 10 or 15 feet when you go 10 miles apart. Because Mars is a planet that has half the diameter of the Earth, the same number of miles on the surface are going to be twice as much bulging up of Earth curvature, if you know what I mean. So for a bunch of reasons, Even if I do a clear terrain comparison of Earth versus Mars, I'm going to have a shorter range on Mars because of a greater amount of Mars curvature because it's half the diameter of the Earth. And one other thing that helps me from time to time, let me drop. A good number of times during the year, my 2-meter Yagi antenna on top of my house, if that's where it was, could easily talk to a guy 200 miles away with his Yagi on top of his house. And I'm using 100 watts and he's using 100 watts. And we're talking to each other beautifully at 1 o'clock in the morning. That is the super reflection phenomenon. In other words, what happens on most summer evenings as the air cools, you start getting dew forming on the grass. You get a heavy moisture content of the air atmosphere low to the earth and drier air up higher in altitude. Because water vapor has a high dielectric constant, the atmosphere that's lower to the ground has a higher dielectric constant than the air up high. Therefore, you get a downward bending of the wave. So that wave leaving my Yagi on top of my house, going to that guy down in Virginia, 200 miles away, experiences curvature of the beam, and when the signal going through that air mass with that gradient of atmospheric dielectric constant, when that curvature of the beam follows the curvature of the earth, the guy in Virginia sounds like he's in my backyard. Instead of getting normal inverse square law, I'm getting inverse linear law instead of inverse square law. The signal could be easily 30, 40, 50 dB stronger than normal. That atmospheric refraction phenomenon, you're not going to get it on Mars because there's almost no atmosphere there. So line of sight, handy-talkie to handy-talkie on Mars are going to work very well. But when it comes to a clear terrain comparison, you're going to get a shorter range, and you're not going to get sporadic E, and you're not going to get the super refraction phenomena on Mars. Those are some of my first guesses. And that's what I think is going to happen on frequencies like 6.2 meters and 450 megacycles. Barry, I bet you've got some opinions along these lines. Let's see what you think. N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, that's why I wanted you to bring up the frequency. Here on Earth, we have other effects when you go to the lower frequency, and they're not going to get those on Mars. So I think that the low frequencies are going to act a lot like the higher frequencies, except that they do bend a little better. So the line of sight, I guess you call it, would be a little better on Mars on the lower frequencies.
On a good day when the band is open on 20 meters, I can probably easily talk to my buddy in, let me pick a place, Hawaii, Japan, places like that. What's really happening is that 14 megacycle, 20 meter signal is bouncing a number of times between Earth and ionosphere in order to get there, as long as it chooses the right part of the sunspot cycle, the right number of hours per day, where the gray line is in the right place. My buddy in Japan and I are going to talk to each other on 20 meters because of that signal bouncing back and forth between ionosphere and Earth. With a small fraction of 1% of the amount of atmosphere on Mars that we've got on Earth, I am guessing that there's very little ionosphere around Mars. Therefore, on 20 meters on Mars, you're not going to talk to somebody 5,000 or 10,000 miles away.
Well, Dick, with all these satellites we have around Mars, they must know that answer pretty good by now.
There's a sort of a yes and a no to that, Barry. Almost all of those satellites are using VHF, UHF, and SHF frequencies. In other words, the lowest frequency they use is probably around 250, and the highest frequency they use is probably around 8.5 gigahertz. So they're looking for direct line of sight, surface to satellite, and they're not looking for the lower frequency ionospheric reflections, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to 20 meters, I am guessing that we don't have very much 20-meter propagation characteristics of Mars with the currently used satellites. N2 Moon Bounce, wait for the beeps, K2LAW.
Okay, now, does Mars ever have an aurora?
I think the answer is no, but I'm not sure. And when we get a chance to talk to the space portion of our net tonight with Paul, WS2N, I'll ask him that question. I know I have seen auroras in the photographs taken of Jupiter and Saturn. I don't think I've ever seen an aurora on Mars in any of the NASA-supplied photographs. So there's so little atmosphere there. Even though those charged particles of the solar wind coming out of the sun, these are millions of pounds of material being boiled off by the sun continuously, flying out of there at a million miles an hour, and it comes and hits our Van Allen belt and gets charged, it gets coupled by the Van Allen belt into the North and South Pole region, and we start seeing an aurora when those charged particles hit our atmosphere in those areas.
I have a comment on this.
I think there is no Van Allen belt around Mars because Mars does not have a magnetic field per se. Very little magnetic field, very little atmosphere. Go ahead with your comment on that one, Wes. N2XJN, K2RAW.
Science daily from December 13, 2005. It states about the hundreds of auroras detected on Mars. And it says auroras similar to the Earth Northern Lights appear to be common on the Mars, according to the physicists at the University of California, Berkeley, who have analyzed 6 years' worth of data, the Mars Global Surveyor. That's the comment on it, and I have a humoristic one. Does the AFCC has the authority over the Mars two-way radio conversation? Anyway, a real question. As we know, Marconi introduced radio wave communication to the world at the same time in 1921. He was shut down with his plan of USOM. What was the history of the birth of the ACC or the controlling agency? What was behind that? Was it one single entity with the big money who wants to reverse the future business for itself and to Adria?
Because there's so many charged particles coming out of the sun, even though you've got a very tenuous atmosphere on Mars, maybe there really is aurora on Mars, and so maybe my guess is wrong. But when it comes to real ionospheric reflection on 20 meters, I'm worried that you're not going to get anywhere near as much of that on Mars. And I think you might not have clearly defined Van Allen belts, because Mars has a very small magnetic field by comparison to the Earth. Earth
has a magnetic field. They had to do with the plates and the fact that the Earth has a liquid core, and Mars, they don't think, has that.
I think I agree with you, Barry. The Earth has a iron metallic molten core, and that core rotates at a slightly different rate than the Earth's outer surface does. And that differential rotation of that conductive material, that hot plasma conductive material, sort of explains where the Earth's magnetic field is coming from. Mars itself looks like it has a smaller planet that cooled more rapidly, and it is believed Mars does not have a molten metallic core, so therefore it no longer has the mechanism for making the magnetic field as I understand it. So I think it's got very little magnetic field. Therefore, if there is an aurora on Mars, would it really be over the North Pole if there is no magnetic North Pole? That's an interesting question. So maybe those satellites have seen an aurora effect. However, there's auroras and there's auroras. You allow me to use a camera that's sensitive enough in the ultraviolet region, I might find an aurora around the Earth in a place where your eye says nothing is there. So I wonder now, the Mars satellites that NASA has put up around Mars, how intense was the aurora that they saw? So I don't think the FCC has much control over Mars, because it's we haven't run into that problem yet. There aren't enough people there to really worry about controlling it. What happened in the beginning is you had all kinds of people building and buying spark gap transmitters in the 1920 time frame, and pretty soon they're interfering with each other, and along came the equivalent of the FCC that started controlling it, licensing people and describing frequency regions that you're allowed to use and when you're allowed to use them, how much power you're allowed to use and so on. So we started getting into regulation. So the regulatory constraints, tried to minimize the amount of interference of services that really needed communication. Thank goodness there was a radio on the Titanic, otherwise a lot of people would not have been saved. That radio, and unfortunately, some of the other ships that were nearby, because of the hour of the night when the disaster occurred, had already closed down their radio, and nowhere near as much rescue took place as could have taken place. I think the Carpathia, if that was the one that the radio operator had already closed down, or was it another ship, but you know what I mean. So, these are some guesses as to what Mars is like. Now, because in my opinion, we are not going to see a human being standing on the planet Mars in the next century. That is my belief. I'm not positive of that. But it is so difficult and expensive to get a man there, and it is such a wicked environment to put a man there, you really don't want to do that. You want to send these machines instead. So when it comes to using radio communication, human being to human being on Mars, I don't think we've got to worry about that for a long time to come. Now back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, just one little question. A low-frequency receiver on Mars, like 160 or the broadcast band, you know, down there, would they be receiving any kind of static at all?
When you and I want to communicate on a band like 1 megacycle, or 3.5 megacycles, 80 meters, whether or not the ionosphere is supporting that communication makes a huge difference as to whether or not we do talk to each other. Because the atmospheric noise, we call it atmospheric noise, but it's really the universe. The universe makes a hell of a lot of noise at those frequencies. And our radio signal has to compete with that. If I'm sending a signal on 2 meters between me and you, Barry, and you and I are, let's say, 30 miles apart, that 2-meter signal gets there very easily. If I send an 80-meter signal to you, between me and you, that 80-meter signal gets there very easily, directly through the air. That's the good news. But the amount of noise that your antenna sees on 80 meters from the rest of the universe is equivalent to a 40-decibel noise figure. So unless I've got ionospheric aid in that signal going from my house to your house, you don't hear that signal. When the ionosphere reflects the signal, it makes 30 or 40 dB louder than the direct through the air signal does. So that 80 meter signal is getting there. It's being swamped out by D layer absorption and atmospheric noise. I believe an awful lot of that so-called atmospheric noise, which is really coming from space, I think you're going to get still an awful lot of that on Mars, is my guess, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
Okay, but the other thing is, if you were to communicate on Mars from one place to the other, and of course you'd have to go over the horizon several times, let's say, you would be better off using a lower frequency because they do bend better. You get a naturally more bending of the low frequency signal over the horizon as you go up in frequency. That effect isn't so good. So point-to-point communication on Mars over the horizon, and Mars has a much closer horizon too, would be better on a lower frequency.
Maybe yes, maybe no, Barry. What you're calling bending, that's called extended ground wave, and you think it happens better at the lower frequencies. The lower frequencies give you much more ionospheric reflection. And you could call that bend if you like, to talk three times beyond the radio horizon. But there are times when I could be trying to communicate between me and the guy in Virginia, and the 2-meter signal absolutely positively does not get there. He and I go up to 10 gigahertz, and the signal gets there like gangbusters. The signal bends beyond the horizon on 10 gigahertz when it didn't on 144 megacycles. I have experienced that many times. So, do the lower frequencies bend more easily? That's not so clear.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You and I have heard those kind of situations. So, does the lower frequency signal really bend? I'm not so sure. Because the ionosphere is doing the majority of what you and I call bend. We've never really had an experiment where you and I use an HF frequency on a on a 300-mile range between here and Virginia and North Carolina without an ionosphere and got the signal through. I don't know.
If the wave bends, then there would be a proof of the mass existence in within the energy sent. So they cannot bend due to the science that is leading right now. And
I know you've discussed on a number of occasions, Wes, whether or not gravity creates bending of a radio wave. And on Earth, under normal circumstances, I say the answer is no. If I'm talking through a galaxy, which has got a huge amount of mass, and I'm listening to the signal coming from a star that is twice as far away, yes, you do get gravity lensing effect when you have a huge amount of mass. And the amount of gravity lensing we're talking about is a fraction of 1 degree of bending of the electromagnetic signal from that far galaxy when it goes at a grazing angle near a slightly closer galaxy that has a huge amount of mass. So gravity lensing is a very gradual phenomenon, and for all practical purposes, I don't think we get it on Earth. That's my belief. So the bending of the wave, I think to talk beyond the horizon in Mars is going to be difficult.
So what about circulators? What is the kid doing in circulators?
Circulator does not work by gravity.
So that would be the mirror rotation, right?
A circulator works by gyrotropy. In other words, when I mix a magnetic field into the right kind of ferrite material, like yttrium iron garnet, when I've got a yeek material undergoing a biasing of a magnetic field inside of the circulator, I've got a signal that flows in a clockwise manner between the three ports. I've got a signal that flows in a counterclockwise manner. One signal propagates more rapidly than the other. Therefore, I can get a signal that flows from port number one toward port number two.
I know that. The thing is that isn't that the medium is important, the medium is important in order for us to justify facts of bending effect.
What goes on in a circulator is not a bending effect. It is two different velocities of propagation when you go against or in favor of the magnetic field in that material, the magnetic field that biases it. So a circulator is not a gravity effect. It's a magnetic field effect with the right kind of intermediate when you've got the right kind of permeability of material. The right kind of material with the right kind of permeability and the right kind of, what's the word I'm looking for now?
Dig. The Schumann effect is the proof, and it's a scientifically proven proof of the existence of the circulator in between the ionosphere and the surface of the Earth for 7.88 hertz and 23.
Yeah, but at 7 hertz, we don't run ham radio. So although that may be true, it's not easy to use in this particular environment. So as I see it, John, communicating on Mars with handy talkies is not going to be a hell of a lot easier. Could be a bit harder than it is on Earth. And you better set up some repeater sites. Mars does have some very tall mountains, 2 or 3 times higher than the mountains we get on Earth. So stake the high ground. As soon as you get to Mars, John, stake the high ground, put your repeaters there. You're going to need them to get reliable radio communication. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I want to thank Barry for his input on this. He went a little further. Very good, Dick. Now, the next thing, well, first of all, my view on the aurora. Don't forget, without, on Earth, the magnetic poles cause it to concentrate, so it is easier to see here. So it's easier to photograph. Now, there could be very nebulous aurora, possibly on Mars, but don't forget, they also can photograph aurora with the right equipment of a person. You can see the aurora effect on them. So I guess they could photograph some aurora on Mars. But the next question on the same subject is, from this gentleman, is the fact that
Mars has more iron content on the surface than Earth, it appears. What about that counterpoise structure of that? How will that affect communications? Will it make no difference at all, or do you think it would improve? Kick that around for a while. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Mars has a red color because it's got a lot of iron oxide on its surface. And is that a more conductive material? I mean, an awful lot of the places on Earth that give us very good ground conductivity, so we can easily set up a ground plane antenna with higher efficiency, usually is because of moisture content increasing the conductivity. Really dry materials don't suddenly become superconductor just because you've flaked some iron oxide flakes in there. So is the Mars soil more conductive than Earth's soil when you consider the amount of dryness of Mars soil? I think the answer is it could have lower conductivity, higher resistivity of material. So when it comes to setting up an antenna on Mars, if you want that antenna to be efficient, I think you're still going to want to put up a good ground, a good counterpoise.
What about the reflectivity?
That's a tough one. There, I don't know. I think the amount of reflectivity you get off of dry Mojave soil, Mojave Desert in California, I think the reflectivity you get off of it is lower than you would get out of a nice, moist soil you've got on Long Island, particularly near the seashore. So Mars is so darn dry, I think the reflectivity of Mars is going to be somewhat like the Mojave Desert on the United States, in the desert in California, is my guess. Now, when it comes to transmitting above, beyond the horizon, they'd like to have high reflectivity off the soil, high reflectivity off the ionosphere, and you bounce back and forth between the two to go on beyond that horizon. I think you're going to get very little ionosphere on Mars. So communicating beyond the horizon, I think, is going to be tough. The forward propagated tropospheric scatter that we get here in the United States, if you use a large enough antenna with a high enough effect